You're listening to My White Belt, the best jiu-jitsu podcast in the world. Enjoy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of My White Belt. I am your host, Jim Trick. And last week we had Notorious Nick Newell on. Anytime I get to have somebody on who has been there and done that and has come out on the elite side, it's one thing to push through and to overcome. It's another thing to push through and overcome to the point of being on a world stage, competing as one of the best with the best. And I actually think I listened to that episode a couple of times. It's amazing to me how guys like Nick and, you know, and women like, you know, Jiu-Jitsu Grandma or Alex Barcelona, who's been on. It's amazing to me people who are able to push to the point of greatness. And I felt like that idea of pushing to the point of greatness was really evident in our conversation with Nick Newell last week. So thank you for listening to that. We got a great response to Nick's episode. He really is. It's cool because he's inspirational, but he's not setting out to be inspirational. He wants to be a world-class fighter. He is a world-class fighter. But in terms of like doing a song and dance about only having one hand and making that a thing, it's literally just not important to him. It's all he's ever known. And the other thing that he knows is that he loves jiu-jitsu, loves fighting, and is great at it. And like, obviously, I'm not saying that it doesn't matter. Obviously, it's, you know, some level of a factor, and he thinks about it. And I'm sure that he sees himself as, I mean, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, but he is an inspirational figure. But I wanted to really get into the other parts of him, which I think we did well. So a couple weeks ago, you got to meet Liam McGowan, my coach. If you have not listened to that episode, if you love the My White Belt show and the platform, but you have not listened to that particular episode, I very highly recommend that you go back and listen to the crazy conversation that I had with my own coach, Liam McGowan. You've heard me say it before that Hicks and Gracie said that the head professor of any jiu-jitsu academy is going to unquestionably and undoubtedly shape the culture of a particular school. And Liam has definitely shaped the culture of our school to the point where we are all a little crazy. And today I get to introduce you to another member of my own jiu-jitsu family. I'm really excited. Today our guest is Kurt Veed. He was a naval intelligence officer. He was the lead interrogator for a special operations task force in Iraq. He was a member of the Stop SWAT team for the Mass State Police. He worked with the Secret Service and State Department on presidential and dignitary protection, including three different presidents and vice presidents, as well as people like the Dalai Lama. So Kurt actually played a large role in the response team to the Boston Marathon bombing and has served with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. He is a fascinating, fascinating guy. He's an academic as well with an advanced degree in criminal justice from Western New England University. He's out of his mind. all of those things, his accomplishments, all of the things that he's done, and he's a nut job, just like most of all of us at First Colony. And I mean that in the best possible way. And so, yeah, is he a dangerous guy? He just got his brown belt. He's He's like 6'2 or 6'3, I think. Probably weighs around 240 pounds. He's a big, strong warrior of a guy, and he is about as silly as a person could possibly be. He is literally today when we were rolling, I'm going to ask him about this when we get into the interview, but he like will make up little songs. Today, as he was crushing me, he was making up a little ditty that he decided to sing to me. My white belt is brought to you in part by Origin. Origin up in Maine. They make geese, Jocko Fuel. You know Jocko Willink, famed Navy SEAL. He's an amazing author, speaker, and now he has a company called Origin where they make boots and jeans and belts and a whole host of other incredible American-made goods. And one of the goods that they make jiu-jitsu gear. They make gis and rash guards and spats. And I will tell you, I have four of their gis. It's what I roll in. I love them. They are incredible quality, made by incredible people in the great state of Maine. If you are looking for a new gi, or if you're thinking about getting into supplements, or if you like energy drinks, he makes a Jocko Fuel has a go drink that's not only delicious and refreshing, but it gives you a boost without giving you a crash. So if you're in the market for a gi, a pair of jeans, you hear me talk about this every week. I'm not going to stop talking about it. I'm only ever going to share products with you and companies with you that I love, that I believe in, and that I use. I love, believe in, and use Origin and Jocko Fuel products. I hope that you are using them. If you do, or if you're thinking about using them, if you use the discount code TRICK10, that's TRICK and the number 10, you will save money off of your order and you will support the work of my white belt. I hope that you will enjoy and find useful and inspirational this conversation with the incredible Kurt Veed. Welcome to my white belt. How weird is this?
This is awesome. Thanks for having me, Jim.
It's my absolute pleasure. So you were singing me a song today when we were rolling, and it was something like "Keep on squirming, little guy."
I don't know. I was making it up because I had you like a high cross mount or something.
And it was something awful.
Your bottom arm was trying to wiggle its way out. And I don't know. It was kind of a jerk move. I shouldn't have done that.
It was all right. Listen, hey, here's the thing. It's one thing to like roll and have a jerk move. And it's another thing to roll, have a jerk move, and have the 240-pound killer on top of you singing you a little ditty.
I don't know about any of that, but you know, I do think I laugh about it sometimes. Sometimes I'm like, oh, should I have done that? You know, but it just pops out of my head. And two, I'm like, if we can't have fun doing this, like I think after that, the role that you and I had, I was rolling with Liam and we were giggling about something in the middle of it. And, you know, this isn't, We're not in an operating room at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, right, saving lives.
Right.
Let's be perfectly honest, right? We are just a bunch of people trying to better ourselves every day. And it sounds corny, but I think you should feel comfortable and be happy and be able to just relax. And fortunately, you've been doing this a while. I've been doing this a while, and we can relax. We don't feel like we did when we had our white belts, right?
Yeah, that's for sure. I probably don't relax as much as you do, but I definitely relax more than I did that first my first week. And, you know, I recorded the intro before this, but I'll just, because this comes up from time to time. Sure. I definitely was not relaxed during my first week where I need you in the face. And you came up with your epic response, which was, you know, after the stars stopped, the cartoon stars stopped spinning around your head, and you said, "That's all right. We're not here to bake cakes." And I was like, "Well, shit. I guess yeah. we're not in Kansas anymore."
But it's definitely, it's a contact sport, and things are going to happen. I mean, I came home yesterday with this is a small, little, insignificant nick on my nose, but yeah. it's not unusual, as you know, to come home with a black eye or.
Yeah, I love it.
Or, you know, and I think it builds a little bit of resilience in your life. Right?
There's nothing more satisfying for me. And you know my background, and the audience knows my background. There's nothing better for me than to have a black eye or a limp or something going on, and somebody going, "Wow, where'd you get that black eye?" And to be able to go, "From jiu-jitsu."
Yeah.
Instantly right. Feel like a badass.
Well, you feel like a kid again.
Yeah. You absolutely feel like a kid. And to other guys, it's like, we get it, because we never really grow up, right? We just get older.
That's it.
But women just kind of look at us and go, "Oh yeah, sorry, you must still be 9.
Yeah. I get it from my wife all the time, you know, I don't know. That's just, I hope I never lose that.
Yeah.
Humor or easygoing.
We're going to double back to the fact that you are probably one of the happiest, most joyful guys on the mat. And, you know, like listening to you talk right now, listen, we're not at Brigham and Williams Hospital. I'm going to edit that so I can actually say we're not in an operating room. We're right. Not surgeons. Right. But you really do practice what you preach. And I know a lot of your story, but what I don't really know is where this all begins for you, like as a kid. Like when does Kurt Veed decide that he's going to make a career in the field that you have worked in? When does fighting start for you?
Jeez. I grew up, I was born up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. My father was in the Air Force. Married my mother as a nurse, very traditional. You know, I'm pretty redneck, yeah. And I don't mean to say that in a bad way or anything like that. But it's very rural. My father's from Kentucky, my mother's from Maine originally. So insert joke there, right?
Yeah, right.
But you know, I was around the military my entire life. You know, and early on, I just was always into, G.I. Joe, soldiers, things like that. And then this all happened right around the same time, right around 8, 9, 10. I got a hold of an old Soldier of Fortune magazine that my uncle had in Vietnam. And I saw some stuff that I just was like, oh. It just resonated. I don't know what it is. And I saw a thing on the SEALs, and there was nothing on Navy SEALs at the time. This was a magazine from 1978. It's not like now with the military,
right?
You pull up YouTube and you are interested in doing anything, not just military, obviously. Right. It's yeah. there. Right. When you and I were growing up, certain fields, there was just none of that out there.
Yeah. Obviously. There was a kid in our middle school who had an Asian World of Martial Arts catalog, and that thing was ripped. You would have thought it was a Playboy. Yeah. And we had this magazine, and for like, I think probably all of seventh grade, all we did was like, look at this catalog about like, you know, nunchucks and Chinese stars and like.
Yeah. And I think you and I talked about that. You know, there was in my house, all I had were, I was really interested in martial arts growing up. So yeah. I played a little bit of baseball for a couple of years, like little league, but yeah. I never really was a big organized sport guy for the most part. I was always doing the weird stuff. Like I was interested in martial arts and then later on climbing, you know, and ice climbing, things just, I was always interested in like tough things. Right. And I'm sure a shrink could analyze me and be like, this is you trying to validate who you are as a human being by proving your self-worth by testing yourself. But I was always into that. And then,
it doesn't sound like you point to any trauma where that would even be. It sounds like you literally grew up in a military household and thought this was cool.
Yeah.
And I mean, end of story.
Yeah. I mean, I probably had as much trauma as anybody else, normal stuff, you know what
right.
I mean? Nothing crazy. But I remember I saw Rambo First Blood when it came out. And I was like, oh my God. Right. And I was like, that's it. That's it. And so from then on, I was only concerned about the military and doing martial arts. And I did a karate for a brief period of time.
How old?
Probably 9, right?
Okay. Like and our then, typical karate lessons that we all grew up doing.
Yeah, it was like whatever. And then we were living over in Europe. I lived in Europe for about almost 8 years total growing up. And then when we came home from Europe the last time, I was 12. And we got back up to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, up to Pease Air Force Base when it was up there. And we were
We used to go grocery shopping there when I was little.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Great. My dad was retired Navy, hanging out at the commissary.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time there. I used to work there, that whole thing. Yeah.
Did you ever get lunch at Yokin's?
Oh, 100%. I know it very well. That was my grandfather's big hunt.
I wonder if we were ever at Yokin's at the same time.
I wouldn't be surprised. I spent enough time there.
They had that treasure chest in the gift shop that after you filled up on fried seafood, you walk in there and try to see if your key fit the gift shop. What a great racket to get people to go into the gift shop.
Total racket. I doubt anybody ever got anything.
No, I actually heard that what would happen is if you were like a special needs person or something and you had something going on, that they would slip you the key and you'd win a little like a $10 gift card to Yokin's.
That is the sweetest thing.
It's the best thing ever. I didn't find out about it until like I was too, you know, until I was old enough to get the sweetness of it. And I wouldn't have been like, that's a racket. But no.
I loved it.
Europe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were up at Pease Air Force Base and I remember I was some building again. This is 1987. So there's no internet. And there was a flyer for a Taekwondo class.
Come on.
The instructor was this guy named Master Sunwoo Park. And he had just come over, huge influence on my life. And he had just come over from Korea just a few months earlier. And, you know, he was making a go of it, running a school. And it was the thing, you know, like taping flyers up on poles, you know, and doors.
Yeah.
And there was a picture of him doing this, like this split kick, double split kick.
Yeah.
Right. And I was like, you know, he had the kind of the wild 80s hair, you know, like, you know, from like the martial arts movies, and he had the look. And I was like, oh, I want to do that. And my parents went over, and that was in March, April of 87. We were just, I was the only kid there. I was sparring against grown men.
Wow. Right?
Very old school, very, like he just came over from Korea. A lot of the class was taught Korean. His English wasn't very good at the time.
When you say he had a big impact on your life, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, I spent the next 4.5 years training under him, and I got my black belt, and I competed all over New England with the U.S. Open twice.
Mm.
I did so well at the time in my weight class and my division, you know, being you know, 15 years old, that's probably the peak, 14, 15. Yeah. I was going all over the place that I got to go to the Olympic Training Center at Lake Placid for a week and train with these Olympic athletes and got all that exposure. And it was just an incredible experience. And, but he taught me, it was funny because when I would get in trouble, you know, growing up, I'd get in a fight or I got caught one time playing football on the roof of a school and, you know, little things like that, right? Stupid right. thing.
Yeah.
And, my parents, I'll never forget, my parents were kind of close to him. And, they would be like, hey, you want me to go talk to Master Park? You want me to tell him what you did? And I'm like, no.
Wow. You no. weren't getting away with anything.
No. So between my father and my mother, great parents, they're still with us, thank God. But they're old school. I mean, they're pretty old school. So between that and, you know, that, then Taekwondo, and it's a huge influence. And then, you know, when I was a sophomore in high school, we moved up to Maine, and I kind of stopped doing Taekwondo, and I took up wrestling.
I didn't know you wrestled in high school?
Yeah, 2 years in high school, yeah.
It's no wonder that I can't get anywhere with you.
I don't know about that, man.
Yeah, I do. And it's all making sense. So when you were in the Navy.
Yeah.
So what happens in terms of I have so many questions, because for all the time that I've known you and, like, you know, all the time we spent training together and getting coffee together and all that stuff, I just feel like there's so much to your story, and I get these little pieces here and there. How did you choose the Navy? Why the Navy and not the Air Force?
It just simply came down to, I saw that magazine when I was a kid, that Soldier of Fortune magazine.
Yep.
And I saw there, like, Navy SEALs, toughest training on the planet. And I was like, whoa, this sounds awesome. And I knew I was going to do something, you know. Of course, you know, you see First Blood, the guy's a Green Beret and that, and the A-Team, those guys were Green Berets. Remember the A-Team?
Yeah, I loved it.
The best show ever, right?
Best show ever.
And it was always stuff like that. Or you saw The Deer Hunter, and you got Robert De Niro. sad movie, but he was legit badass in the movie, right? And I was like, I knew I was going to do something. And then I saw a couple things on the SEALs, and nobody in my family had been in the Navy. I got guys that were in the Air Force, Army. I got a bunch of World War II veterans in my family, a bunch of veterans in my family, all, you know, pretty distinguished soldiers and whatnot, but no one had been in the Navy. And then when I saw that it was tough as it was, I was like, I want to go in the Navy. And, I was a pretty semi-decent artist in high school. I didn't like high school, but I liked art class and history class.
Yep.
And my father wanted me to go to art school, and I was like, I'm going to waste your money if I go to art school.
That's amazing that your dad, who is a veteran, said, hey, listen, I really want you to go to art school.
He wanted me to have an education. He wanted me to have, you know, I mean, he grew up about as poor as you could get. I mean, I'll give you an idea how poor he was. He gained weight in boot camp. No, people don't gain weight.
Wow.
He gained weight. It was the first time he'd ever eaten three meals a day. Right. So he grew up, and my mother wasn't too much better than him, rather. So he wanted me to have better life than he had. Right.
Yep.
And I just was, I was focused. I couldn't stop. I just couldn't stop myself. And I joined the Navy.
When you went through boot camp, you must have been in pretty good shape, right? Because you had been traveling around New England doing Taekwondo.
And I lived on, when we moved to Maine. So my grandfather, when he came home from World War II, he bought a camp. He worked at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard after he got out of the service until he retired. And they bought a camp on a lake in the 50s.
Right. Wow.
And, about 10 minutes actually from where Travis trains up in Sanford.
Right on Sanford Grappling Club.
Grappling, right? And so Travis knows exactly what I'm talking about. And we lived in Acton, Maine. And Well, they had a camp there. So when my dad retired from the Air Force, my grandmother offered to give my parents the property. They demoed the camp and they put a house there on the lake.
Wow, nice.
So my last 3 years, I mean, I grew up there, but my last 3 years of high school was on a lake getting ready for the Navy. So I was swimming and it was in the woods. There's hills. There's
mountains. Running, swimming, lifting heavy stuff.
I was in really, really, really good shape. And I went in the Navy. Yeah, 93.
And when you think about the guys that you enlisted with, you know, people go into the service for lots of different reasons. You and I come from military families. If I had served in the military, it would have been to, like, you know, honor my dad and carry on that tradition. Sure. And that was something that you were really compelled by, probably a combination of, you know, your dad and Soldier of Fortune magazine, which this is like, your life is the best advertisement for the late 70s Soldier of Fortune magazine, you know? Oh,
100%. So many people in my peer group, that's why they went in.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not alone by that. If you listen to great authors that are prevalent now, like Jack Carr,
he's
a big time author, Tired Seal, and I'm not the only one, you know, it's almost identical stories. I saw First Blood. I did this, I did that. I'm from this generation. My grandfather was this or that.
Yeah.
And you decided to go in, and I went in the military and I loved it. I mean, unfortunately I didn't get to go to SEAL training right away. They sent me out to a ship. It's a long story, longer than this podcast has, but I did 2 years on a ship. And it was epic. I went all over the world. It was like an Ernest Hemingway novel. I mean,
really?
I was in the Mideast. I was in the Caribbean. I was in the North Atlantic in January. I mean, we were all over the place, all over Europe, all over the Mediterranean. And I got to see these amazing places and live like a sailor. I mean, it was pretty rad.
Any port in a storm.
Any port in a storm, buddy. And it was fun.
This is going to be like a weird, I'm just going to ask this question. Have you ever gone through a period of your life where your peers or the people around you would have described you as a prick?
Not a prick. No.
Yeah. Like,
I don't think so.
Yeah. You weren't like a hardo. You weren't like a hardo jerk who like softened up.
No. I've always been this way. I mean, I've had my, you know, my struggles, like a lot of veterans, with like post-traumatic stress and stuff.
Sure. That's different though. And like that's
normally that's reserved to the four walls of this house, you know, for the most
part.
But I've never been real controversial in terms of, you know, I've never been considered no one's called me really an asshole, I don't think.
So I want to talk about the transition. I want to talk about the transition from everything into jiu-jitsu, because this is a jiu-jitsu podcast. But
sure.
And I will have talked about some of your bio in the introduction. But U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer, lead interrogator for a Special Force Operation Task Force in Iraq, Mass State Trooper. You were a task force officer. You have come up through like a path paved with hardos and tough guys. And how did you respond to guys with axes to grind and something to prove?
I think everybody does on a certain level have something to prove, right, to themselves.
Okay.
Maybe to a father who was an asshole to them, or a teacher that told them they weren't going to amount to anything.
Yeah.
Well, I mean that's just about everybody I've ever met. You know,
right?
That's where I came from. You know, I mean, and
where did you learn to treat people well?
My parents. My parents were always super nice. My grandfather's, my mother's father had a reputation of being just a very nice guy. He died when I was really little. My parents are very, very friendly, easygoing, churchgoing. They don't swear. They're just nice people.
Yeah.
And that was just my role model. And I was around people at an early age in the military that weren't nice to me. There were people that were just total jerks.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it. I didn't want to be treated that way. I didn't want to treat other people that way.
Yeah.
I noticed that if you were a hard worker and you were nice to people, people would go out of your way to take care of you. You know, like, so I was a kid. I mean, you're 18. Let's be honest. You're 18 years old. You're a freaking kid, right?
Totally. We didn't think so when we were 18.
We didn't think so. I thought I was like Johnny Utah. I thought I was the man at 18, right?
Right.
And little did I know that, you know, I'm barely out of diapers. And I worked hard and I was nice. And because of that, I had some really good mentors.
Yeah.
You know, I knew what I wanted to do in the Navy at the time, you know, and finally got it in because I worked hard. So I finally made it SEAL training. And then unfortunately I got really hurt.
You got hurt in SEAL training.
Oh yeah. 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 So I never was a SEAL, right? I got out of the military, but the whole reason I even got the opportunity is because I was a nice guy who worked hard and I kept my mouth shut and I wasn't considered a jerk. And at least that's what I think. Did I work hard? And you have to work hard to get anywhere.
Right.
It doesn't matter if it's a special school or a degree program or whatever it is. You got to work hard. And I did. But I also wasn't a jerk.
I mean, I'll tell you, we've been talking about having you on for the longest time. And I wanted to have, in terms of our school, I wanted to have Liam on first before I started having other guys on. But part of why, the last couple of weeks we've been talking about getting you on, my schedule has been weird and it's just been weird. But this past weekend, I watched Roadhouse, which I haven't seen Roadhouse probably in 10 or 20 years. I don't know how long it's been since I watched Roadhouse, but Patrick Swayze comes to town and he stands up in front of this room full of bouncers. And the third rule, he goes, and the third rule is be nice.
Just be nice.
And they all look at him like he's crazy. And I was like, that's Kurt. That's Kurt Veed. Kurt is the baddest dude in the room. But
I don't know about all, that.
But every, and he's also humble, but everything is like a sort of like a canopy over all of your strength, skill, experience is just be nice.
Yeah, there's no. I saw some really, really tough people growing up, even before joining the military. My father, I mentioned earlier, is a super nice guy. He's also the toughest man. Arguably one of the toughest people I ever met. And he didn't have to go around and like stick his chest out. And I saw early on, like, the sweetest, nicest people many times are the toughest in the room. It's the guys that act like they're Joe. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's some people that are like, they look mean, they act mean, they are mean, and they can back it up.
Right.
You know? But for the most part, I've seen some really beautiful people who just smile and they're just like, hey, how you doing? And, you know, I got a few buddies that I worked with in the military that were, they should be writing books about them and filming movies about them. And in fact, if they did, people would call BS on some of the, they'd be like, no, that never happened. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it just seems so ludicrous. And there's this, you'd be like, wait a second, you were in the survey. You did what?
Right.
You should be, you know, I don't know, working at a coffee shop. You just smile, you know,
right.
You don't need to act like a, you know, some sort of hard-o tough guy.
I think that people, you know, obviously, you know, this whole my white belt thing, a big part of it is encouraging people to at least try jujitsu. And if they're in their first year or two, to really stick with it and commit to it. But I think people who don't train look at the idea of Brazilian jiu-jitsu and they think that it's going to be really intimidating. They think they're going to go in and it's going to be like militaristic and like hardos. And maybe that's how it was. Maybe that's how it was back in the day. But if you hear the Gracie kids talk about training with Helio, they all say that he was kind and made it playful and made it fun.
What, I don't understand why you wouldn't want it, wouldn't want that, right?
Yeah.
For the majority of the schools, right?
Right. Yeah.
because I look at jiu-jitsu, it's not like anything. It's no different than a lot of other things. So say you were just going to a regular gym, like a workout, lift weights, run cardio type of gym, right?
Yeah.
You got Gold's Gym in Venice Beach with pro bodybuilders there.
Right.
That would be intimidating for me. Right?
Yeah, me too.
Right. And then you got, you know, Planet Fitness, which I would want nothing to do with, but
yeah, my not intimidating for either of us.
No, but that's the two opposite ends of the spectrum, right? And there's a place for everybody on that spectrum, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you're a young kid and you're like, hey, I want to make competition my goal, you know, well, you might want to go to a competition type gym.
Yeah.
It's very tough. It's very, there might be blood on the mat. There might, you know what I mean? There might be guys just getting after on a level that you and I are not, certainly at our age,
right,
prepared or have any desire to for. But I think the vast majority of people that train jiu-jitsu, just like going to a gym, they don't want Planet Fitness and they don't want Venice Beach bodybuilding.
They want something
to better their lives.
Yes.
Right. And that's why, like, when we were leaving today, when I left with, I walked out with Mike B today.
Yep.
And the girl at the front desk was like, oh, I'd like to try it, but I'm so intimidated. I'm like, I promise you will not regret walking through those doors and sitting on that mat and starting a class.
I showed her a video of Charlotte rolling and she couldn't believe it. She was rolling against Smirka Monday night and like giving him hell, like, strong grips, pulling him into guard, like not letting him get away.
Right. I mean, so that's amazing. You know?
So your transit. So let's just talk about now. We've got your backstory, and at what point in time do you become aware of jiu-jitsu, and what's your introduction to jiu-jitsu? Like, how long ago was it? How'd you become aware of it? Give me that whole backstory.
I was aware in that. I was aware, like a lot of people, when UFC 1 came out, right? I was doing martial arts at the time. I was wrestling at the time. I saw that. But I was pretty focused on the military. And that was just not, at that time, it was not on my radar to do. And I saw it, but I was like, oh, that's great. That looks really well. But I will say, I also thought it was incredibly intimidating. You know, 18-year-old me seeing the UFC 1, and I was like, whoa. And then hearing the stories about how these guys trained, and then you were just like, whoa. And you see pictures of like Hickson on Black Belt, on the cover of Black Belt magazine.
Yeah.
Whoa, right? And then you'd hear things over the years about jiu-jitsu getting a little bigger. It was making its way into military circles and stuff like that. And, you know, I got out of the military in 97 and I thought I was completely done. And then I got, you know, and then I ended up on the state police, which was another crazy story. And then I thought I was done. And then 9/11 hit and I go back in the service. Well, when I went back in the service, I started seeing little things, you know, guys were doing jiu-jitsu and you'd hear about it, you know, like,
yeah.
The Army.
That was Army, right? So you were Navy,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You were Navy, then you were Mass State Police, then 9/11, then you enlist in the Army.
No. I went back in the Navy.
I see. Were you ever in the Army?
No. Uh-uh.
Why did I have it in my head that you were one of those guys?
No, I worked with the Army.
Okay, maybe that's right.
But I've never served in the Army. So I, you know, 9/11 hits. Like a lot of Americans, I was very upset by it. And I went back in the military. I joined the reserves. Got it recruited for an intelligence program. Got my commission as an officer for that program. And I started my path on that. And, you know, I was working with a lot of different branches. And at the time, the military was really kind of going through a renaissance in terms of gear tactics. I know we were just talking about that recently and really changing the way things were done.
Yeah.
You know, at kind of at warp speed, especially in the early 2000s, mid 2000s. And I started everybody, the Marine Corps and the Army were developing a combatives program. Right. So jiu-jitsu. So the Gracies were going down to very high-end special operations units in the 90s, working with those guys. And then like a lot of things, that's how it filters out to the masses. So they created, the Army created an Army combatives program. And they have like full on like jiu-jitsu style tournaments. You know, there's some striking.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's really wild. And then the Marine Corps created what's called MCMAP, Marine Corps Martial Arts Program. And, you know, I don't know how it is now, but at the time they had literally like a belt system. They had, and it was all these different techniques from all these different martial arts to include jiu-jitsu on the best way to use them on the battlefield. And after 9/11, I was attached to the Marines briefly as a Navy corpsman before I went over to the intel program. I was still a medic with the Navy.
Right.
And the Marines don't have their own medics. They have Navy corpsmen, and I was one of them. And okay. So on drill weekends, I'd go up there and drill with these Marines.
Everybody get along okay?
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic. That's a whole other part. The Marines love Navy corpsmen, right?
My dad was old school Navy, and I don't think back in his day, I don't think the Marines and the Navy got along that great.
Well, the sailors, Marines sometimes like the beef, but Navy corpsmen, that's a whole other category.
Okay, right? Got it.
So, and anyways, every Marine has to go through it's the introductory first week, tan belt at the time they called it. I don't know what it is now. Tan belt Marine Corps martial arts program. And I, as a Navy corpsman, I had to go through that. It was a 5-day combatives program, for lack of a better term.
Right. And
there was grappling involved. A little bit of jiu-jitsu there. You know, it was the first time somebody showed me what a triangle choke was. And I was like, whoa, that's so cool.
Did any of that look like what we do, apart from like that triangle choke?
A little bit. A lot of standing, a lot of takedowns from standing, but a lot of, you know, it was very, a lot of the fat is trimmed off for battlefield stuff. And, you know, and they're using things like edged weapons also. And stuff.
Yeah.
So it was, that's a little different than what we're doing. But
just a little. We don't have any edged weapons.
Yeah.
Apart from your knee on my belly.
And, but that's as far as it went. And then, you know, I think it was in 99, I got on the state police. This was before 9/11. And all I wanted to do was get on their SWAT team for the state.
Right.
And, you know, I was working patrol down in Revere Beach, the old Revere Beach, the way it used to be.
Like, yep.
Pretty violent down there, as you remember.
Yeah.
Right. And I did that for about 6 years. And then I finally made it on the SWAT team. And it was great. And I loved it. I did about 14 years there. I'm going to answer your question here in a second. But, you know, for those 14 years, I didn't really have to put my hands on anybody, right? Not really, right? I mean, you're going to cuff people and stuff, but when a SWAT team enters a room, they're not grappling with anybody. You're grappling with somebody. Tactically, things have gone very bad.
Right.
So that's not what's going on. So I went from working patrol, where you put your hands on people all the time, to going to SWAT, where I didn't really put my hands on anybody.
Right.
And meanwhile, I ran into Liam. You know, Liam and I would do, you know, punch each other in the face at some MMA classes, you know, that we took, you know, in the like 2000 and 2001.
When did you move to Marblehead?
97.
Okay. So you met him right away?
Yeah, a couple years later. Yeah.
Okay.
When he was telling you guys, when I got my brown belt, like he'd see me running around with like rocks on my back and rocks.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, I was getting ready. I was staying in shape. So I'd be running down the street with like a log on my back. Just
right.
Stupid.
Yeah.
And we went to a couple of MMA classes and would, you know, and we'd punch each other in the face and stuff like that. But I didn't know anything. And the UFC was new at the time. It was on Spike TV, I think, at the time. Right. And
wait, so did you know Liam before Liam started training jiu-jitsu?
Yeah, because I remember when he started, he says, "Hey man, I just started this new thing," and he was telling me about it, and I was like, "Whoa." And that sounded cool. And then in 2007, I went over to the school that we used to train at for a tour.
Yeah, okay. I did that tour.
Yeah, I did a tour. had a talk, and I'm like, this sounds great, but I was getting ready to go to Iraq, and my plate was really full.
Yeah.
I had little kids at the time. You know, I'm trying to juggle two different careers. I know I have a deployment coming at some point where I'm going to go overseas. You know, I didn't know if it was Iraq or Afghanistan at the time. And so I wasn't able to do it. And then I came home. I got home from over. I did go overseas and I came home in 2009. And, you know, about a year or so later, I went through a divorce and I needed a social component. And so I started CrossFit for a little while.
Yeah.
You know, for a couple of years. And that was fun. I got really.
That's a thing. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. And it was, it's a great way to meet people with not being in a bar, stuff like that. And then I started dating my now wife. And the thing that got me hooked for jujitsu was we were at a concert, a Kenny Chesney concert, Gillette Stadium. And I was turning 40 that year. And I'm walking through the stadium. I got no gun on me. I got no knife on me. There's a ton of people, obviously. And there's a lot of very physically fit young males who are very drunk.
Yeah.
And getting very rowdy. And I remember thinking and feeling like I felt the palatable like fear, right?
Right.
That I couldn't defend myself or take care of my girlfriend if something went wrong. Because I had been so long since I put my hands on somebody, you know, and even back in the day when you did that, when you were on the side of the road, they didn't really train you. They, law enforcement doesn't do a very good job, you know, for a variety of reasons. And really what the tools they give you aren't really the tools that are acceptable. So you can't just go around just, you know, standing there, you know, put your dukes up, you know, you can't do that. And the UFC is so big and it's grown so much, but more and more people are taking a class or training and, you know, and not always nice people. Right.
Right.
And I remember going, oh my goodness, I don't think I could do this. I don't think I can prepare myself.
See, this is the thing. And this is one of the big things that really, and this comes up all the time, separating. Yeah, I don't want to use the term separating the men from the boys, but it's like this thing where you go, if you take 100 people with Kurt Veed's background, they're gonna ride those coattails in their mind for the rest of their lives and say, "Nah, I did all this stuff, you know." And so if I walk through Gillette Stadium, I'm gonna do fine. But the truth is, it's like a language. It's like speaking a language. If you learn French, you might be fluent in it, but if you go a couple of years and you don't speak a word of French, you're not fluent anymore. It's not like you take the red pill and you have it forever.
Right. And not only are you not fluent, but even worse, in my personal opinion, is that I never wanted to be this guy, and people do it. It's human nature to do it on every level, on some level. Right. But you really got to be aware of, I used to speak French, you know, like,
yeah, I know. Right.
Or I was that quarterback in high school. Yeah, that's great. You used to speak French. Can you speak French?
Right. Yeah, or they'll say, oh, you know, my father spoke French. What does that have to do with you?
What does that have to do with you? Right. So, I used to know how to fight. Well, that doesn't matter today when somebody's trying to assault you or a loved one. Right. So, and it is so easy to get in our comfort zones. We all slip into it on some level.
Yep.
I don't care who you are, you're going to slip into a comfort zone.
Yeah.
The difference is being able to recognize that, hey, I'm getting a little comfortable here.
Get a little soft.
A little soft. And I'm going to do something about it. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And jujitsu was one of those things. That was you doing something about it when you realized a deficiency.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What were your early days of training jujitsu like? And were you and Liam white belts together?
No.
Okay.
So I.
Oh, you were going off to, you were going.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. He started in like 2007 or something like that. And, I started in the fall of 2014 I remember, so I go to this concert in August. I realized that I got to get my act together. And then a couple of weeks later, talk about timing. A couple of weeks later, I'm listening to a podcast, the Tim Ferriss podcast.
Love that guy.
Yeah.
And he steals so much stuff from him.
Right. And he has, and the title of it is The Scariest SEAL That I, Navy SEAL Imaginable, or something like that. It was Jocko Willink.
Yeah, dude. I listened to that.
Nobody had heard of him. Nobody knew who he was.
Right.
I think he just retired a couple of years earlier.
Yep.
And he's talking about jiu-jitsu. And I'll never forget, I'm working out. I got a little shed that I work out in. I'm slinging some kettlebells.
Of course you do.
And I'm listening. And I was like, I remember like saying to myself, you need to get your act together and go train jiu-jitsu. And so I signed up the next day and started training with Liam and those guys in the morning. Mm-hmm. And a couple months later, that's when Liam got his black belt. And literally like 2 months later.
Got it.
And
were you there when he got his black belt?
No, that was a Saturday. I was so new and so out of touch.
Right.
I didn't even really understand that he was getting his black belt. I didn't even really know. It was when I tell you, like, I probably had been there 8 weeks.
Maybe
like,
you had a stripe on your white belt.
I didn't even have a stripe. I was just like,
right.
I was just trying to survive. I was spazzy like so many other people. I had some good training partners, and then I had some not so good training partners.
Can you name them? I'm totally kidding.
That was a struggle because I was worried about getting hurt. I ended up getting hurt a few months later.
I bet.
Jacking up my knee. I had to have surgery. I almost quit.
Yeah.
Liam had to talk me off the bridge. You know, I almost did what so many people do. I tried jiu-jitsu. Right.
I tried
jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, you get the guys who come and they do two classes. I love it. This is the greatest thing. I want to order a gi, and you never see them ever again.
My tattoo, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they disappear. And I was so close to that. I mean, I've told guys, you know, that there were some good things about where we trained, and not some good things. And some people were great, some people weren't. And it was tough. And even a guy, you know, at that point, I'd been on the SWAT team, I'd been overseas, I'd done some stuff in the military. And I can tell you at least two, maybe three times, I either pulled in the parking lot or was walking, about to walk into the building, and I turned around and walked back to my car and drove away.
Really?
Yeah.
What was going on inside?
It was tough. It was tough. It was really tough. A couple times I left there with a bloody face. You know, I had some blood coming out of my nose. I was worried about getting hurt. I was thinking, this is so easy to do. This is so easy to do. You're coming up with excuses. Oh, I'm 40 years old. I shouldn't be doing this. Yeah. Right. By the way, I'd love to be 40 right now.
I would kill to be 40 right now. And especially knowing what I know.
Right. And I was like, I'm too old for this stuff. This is ridiculous, right? And the people that you know that don't understand are like, why are you doing that? You're 40 years old.
Yeah, I know. I was 47 or 48 when I started. And people are still like, why do you do this to yourself? So just to like put a finer point on it, you did karate, black belt in taekwondo, Navy, state trooper, back to the Navy, and your early days of jiu-jitsu were so challenging that you were like, I'm going home today. Yeah. I'm going home today.
Sure.
And then in terms of for everything that you've seen, and the way you described it as a state trooper is having to put your hands on people, How does jiu-jitsu rank in your mind in terms of an effective way of protecting yourself and subduing an adversary?
I think you should sign paperwork when you become a cop, agreeing that if you're going to be a cop, you will train jiu-jitsu.
And how long were you a cop?
I had been I'd been doing it for 16 years, I think, at that point.
So in the same way that you have to qualify with your handgun and you have to do this, that, and the other thing.
You should have, I signed paperwork saying, and for this is for medical insurance reasons, you know, when it came on in 99, agreeing not to smoke cigarettes or use tobacco, right?
Right.
They can get away with it. It's not like the old days where you can, you know, rip butts all the time. They're like, hey, we're going to give you health insurance. We don't want you to smoke. I totally understand that, right?
Yeah.
You should sign paperwork. They should dedicate 3 hours a week minimum.
Right.
Agreeing that you'll train jiu-jitsu for your career. Period. End of story. It should not even be a debate. You would cut drastically down on any issues. It would be beneficial to not only the officer themselves, but also the public who you're trying to protect and take care of.
Yeah.
You would learn things that would save your life and other people's lives. Obviously, it'd keep you in shape. You'd be nice and healthy.
Right. Right?
It should not even be a discussion.
I mean, we've got a bunch of cops that train with us, and we've got, you know, FBI that trains with us. I won't name names, but so why do so many members of law enforcement avoid it or not do it?
It's not in the culture. It is not in the culture. It's just not.
And are they just thinking that because they've got maybe a taser that they're fine, or
I'll say this. I can say this now because I'm retired and I can give you my opinion. I believe that when they put you through the academy, in some academies are getting more proactive in terms of jiu-jitsu than others. But I can tell you when I got on, it wasn't around. It wasn't discussed. You weren't grappling. You didn't learn anything. You were learning these really like nerve stuns and, I mean, stuff that doesn't work. I can tell you it doesn't work. I've tried it. It doesn't work. I'm not the only one that's tried it.
Yeah.
And that you have a tendency to think that, hey, I have this uniform on and this badge. And you know what? That's going to do all the talking that I need to do. And
yeah.
I have backup and I have a flashlight and I have a taser and I have a gun.
Right.
I'll be okay.
And right.
That's not the case.
At a guy like Mike Everett, Lieutenant Mike Everett, right? Who is like, I'm taller than he is. I'm heavier than he is. And if that guy ever had to arrest me or somebody my size, or you, even you, if you were untrained, right? Your size. In the words of Mr. T, I pity the fool who decides that they're going to try to throw hands with him.
He trains.
He's a second or third degree stripe brown belt, you know?
Because he trained. It's just the value of training. It gives you confidence to know that a 110-pound female, she may not beat that guy that she's training. She doesn't have to, though.
Yeah.
Maybe just enough to pull them in their guard and hold on and get to her mic, her radio that's maybe on the lapel of her collar.
Yeah.
Radio for help and hold that person off. I mean, that is the difference between she can hold them in and say the person is mentally ill, right?
Right.
Use this example. So there's nothing nefarious. They're just they have a chemical problem in their brain. The brain's broken, right?
Right. Yeah.
They don't deserve to be shot. Unfortunately, that happens.
Right.
Because sometimes you're left with no option. And,
right.
and that's a sad fact of the world. But right. What if you could take a lot of that out of the equation and then really minimize the chances of you having to engage in deadly force?
Yeah.
I can tell you when a cop wakes up in the morning, they don't want to shoot somebody. They don't want to shoot anybody, but they definitely don't want to shoot somebody who's having a mental health episode.
Right.
And if they train jiu-jitsu, perhaps they can mitigate the chances of ever having to pull that gun. Maybe they got to use a taser. Maybe they throw the person in a Kimura lock or something. You know what I mean? But they didn't have to use their firearm. And that comes, especially in today's world, you know, that comes with a whole that's a whole training.
Especially in the great state of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So you've got all, how many countries have you been in? Have you counted the number of countries that you've been to? I mean,
I don't know, well over 40.
And well, you're an intelligence. So you've been to over 40 countries. You've been an intelligence officer. Yeah. You've seen tons and tons of, I don't know how you'd say, you've arrested lots of people, right? Like you are uniquely familiar with the evils of the world.
Yep.
And a jiu-jitsu brown belt. Can you believe you got your brown belt?
Mm-mm. No, I can't.
How about that day?
That was pretty wild.
Right? As somebody who trains with you, that was, I was thrilled to see that as such a huge deal.
It's so surreal, man. It's so surreal.
Right.
Amidst, I don't even know. Yeah.
You don't know what, I mean, you earned it. You are it.
But it's just, you know, I've read this and I've heard this before by people that get promoted, maybe to black belt or whatever. They get that imposter syndrome. Right. Yeah. You know, and I kind of feel that. I understand that. It's just, I don't know. You just stick your head down. I'm in my ninth year. Right. And you try to be that person, and it is tough. Don't get me wrong. It is tough to not want another belt. It is tough to not want to be at a certain level.
Yeah.
But time just keeps moving on. Right. And you just keep plugging away. And then all of a sudden you're like, you're feeling happy that you're like, all right, I'm a purple belt. That's pretty impressive. I'm doing well. I'm having a good time. And, you know, I need so much more to learn, and, you know, it'll happen when it happens. And all of a sudden you make brown belt and you're like, whoa, the next time this happens in a few years.
I know.
You're like, and I'm sure I'm not the only person that's ever felt this. I don't even like verbalizing what I just said.
Yeah. I know. I get it. You're going to be a black belt. I'm going to be there. We're all going to cry. It's going to be.
Yeah, I know. I think we're done. I'm past the quitting stage.
Yeah, you're not going. Trust me. If you decided to quit jiu-jitsu, me and a whole bunch of other blue and purple and blue belts would be at your house outside in your driveway with mats making you come out to train with us.
Yeah, I don't understand why somebody would quit, especially at this point. But because it is a life, it's part of who I am, you know, at this point. I feel very fortunate that I've found something that I'm passionate about, because a lot of people struggle through that with that, right?
Finding purpose, finding passion.
And it's not easy, and I get it. And I just feel so fortunate that I found something that puts a legitimate smile on my face. That's why I like jiu-jitsu so much. It really does. And, you know, I was talking to Mike B about this just this morning. You can be having a bad morning, be having a bad day. You may even be dealing with a lot of shit in your life, right?
Right.
But when you go into class for a little while, you get to forget about that stuff.
Yeah.
And if you're especially if your life's going really well and you are already happy, you go in there like skipping almost. You're just happy. That's why I'm sure people they're annoyed by my boisterous laugh they'll hear on the
mat. Oh, never.
I'll be on my back and you'll be sitting on my chest and I'm like howling. You know, because I'm like, why wouldn't you laugh? This is we're having fun.
Well, today I can't remember. You had me pinned, and you had, I don't know if you had neon belly or what you had. What the hell were we doing? Oh, you know what it was? We were doing the leg drag, and you were putting top pressure on me before you sat back into saddle. And I looked up at you, and you had this big grin on your face, and you said, I like to pin guys like this. And I'm sitting there simultaneously like dying because I've got giant Kurt Bead on me and laughing because you looked like a little kid, just so happy.
Well, I feel like a little kid, and I am really happy. That is something I can say, like, at that moment I'm experiencing joy. I'm happy.
It's right? So awesome.
And I can't always say that about everything else in you know, because that's not the way life works.
That's right? Not the way life works. No, but right. Jiu-jitsu is like this place where, and listen, jiu-jitsu doesn't always feel that way either. If we're totally honest.
I've walked out of there. I've thrown my belt before.
Yeah.
blood drip out of my face. I've dislocated my elbow. I mean, we all have this similar story, right?
Right.
Jiu-jitsu is like life. I mean, how many times you've heard like the huge name in the jiu-jitsu community, you know, say these people that you and I respect and millions of other people respect.
Yeah.
And they'll say like jiu-jitsu is life because some days are great. Some days aren't, you know, you struggle. Some days are easy. It goes up and down. It's like a wave, a roller coaster.
Right? Yeah. If Ricardo Almeida can have imposter syndrome, so can you and I, you know what I mean? Tom DeBlas can have a bad day, you and I can have a bad day. 100%. Those aren't quitting.
There's a famous story of, I guess Hickson was rolling with some guys, I think in England or something. He's rolling with these like high level black belts, guys who have fought on like the world stage or something like that. And he crushed them so bad and threw the black belts in the trash. I mean, I don't know if that's been exaggerated or not, but it's a pretty wild story. It goes to show, like any of those guys, if they're around here, we'd be like, oh, you know, the greatest thing ever. And they're so frustrated by their performance against Hickson that they threw their black belts in the trash.
Amazing. Yeah. So, and amidst all of the things that you've done, and I don't need to list them all again, but you also had time to get a college degree in criminal justice. So you have an academic background as well. And now retired from the state troopers, retired from the military, still working, doing some consulting, and you get this idea. How many kids do you have?
Five.
Five kids.
Yeah.
And I know your kids. They're great. I love your kids.
They're awesome. Thank
you. Great. You really have great kids. I see Jameson at the desk there, and I'm just like, look at that kid. And that's a kid who's got joy in his face, you know?
You're happy, kid.
And you've started this thing. comehomesafe.com. Like, can't you just retire? Can't you just stop working?
No, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't want to get comfortable. I'm dead serious. I don't want to be that guy sitting in a bar going, man, I used to do this. I used to be on a SWAT team, or I used to, you know, I was around these amazing military guys or whatever, right? Because I don't think that's good. I mean, I'm only 48.
Yeah.
Hopefully I got another half. I'm halfway, right? Yeah. Hopefully I'm halfway. And so I got a lot of living to do left, and I don't want to stop. I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's good. And
if we were kids, you know, let's go back to 1986, 1987. If we were kids and we were going to go to Europe, if we were going to go to Prague, that'd be a big deal.
Yeah.
We probably wouldn't go do that by ourselves.
No.
But in 2023, the world has gotten so much smaller.
Yeah.
And kids are traveling all the time, all over the place.
100%.
So what is, in a nutshell, what is comehomesafe.com?
Right. So I get the idea. One of my jobs in the military was to get people ready if they were going overseas. And it really can run the spectrum from somebody, you know, just, hey, the ship's about to pull into a port in Spain. We're going to give you guys a quick country brief. These are the do's and don'ts. Go here. Don't go there. That type of thing. Right. To maybe more high end stuff. Maybe you're dealing, you know, going up the food chain in the military or the intelligence community where it's a little more robust presentation. I'll just leave it at that. But on the civilian side, you know, growing up overseas, I lived in Germany. I lived in Holland. And in the 80s or in the 70s or whatever, it wasn't a big deal to walk around and you were fine. And we memorized, you and I, when we grew up, we memorized phone numbers.
Yeah.
Right? There were pay phones around.
Yeah. You'd put your finger in to try to get a dime.
100%. Right. So the world was bigger, but it was simpler.
Yeah.
And stakes weren't as high. And when you and I were little, there was terrorism, but it wasn't like it is now.
Wait, were we little at one point in time?
I think, at some point we were. I think
we were younger.
I was younger.
When we were younger.
And, but I got thinking, you know, hey, if my daughter, like my daughter is going overseas at the end of her this year of school. And I was thinking, what if she had her purse stolen that had a passport, cell phone, cash, all the, you know, phone numbers, contact, all that stuff. What would happen, right? Today, if it was me, if I had that happen, I would be able to figure it out because thankfully I have experience and tools that I've been given and trained on to figure out this. But your average kid traveling overseas, they don't have that.
Right? Yeah.
And it's not a showstopper. They're not, you know, but if you just put yourself in the mindset of a 20-year-old kid in Rome, let's say, and all that stuff I just mentioned is gone, what would they do? Do they know how to get back to their hotel? Mm-hmm. Who do they call? They don't have phone numbers stored in their head. I don't have my phone number stored in my head anymore. Right. So my job, I got the idea to create this company. I created comehomesafe.com. What I do is if your child, and I really focus on students traveling abroad. I mean, I've worked with people that are not students, you know, grown-ups. I just had a talk with a woman the other day. She's traveling to Morocco by herself. She's our age. So I perform the same service for her, but really I focus on high school, college age kids who are doing a semester or a trip abroad. And we go over a lot of different things, good travel safety habits, some backups, plans about, hey, what happens if you lose your purse, right? What happens if your passport is stolen, right? And so I show them things like, you know, making copies of this and that, where to store them, just taking a lot. You're not never going to mitigate all the risk in life, right? But if you can mitigate a lot of it, it's going to make your life that much easier, right? So God forbid your purse is stolen. It's inconvenient. It's frustrating. It's even worth maybe even having a freak out for 10 minutes, but then you're like, you know what? No big deal. Back in my room, I have copies of the following. I have a plan in place. So this is not a showstopper for me. It's inconvenient. It's a pain in the butt, but it's not a showstopper. And then, so I do that. So I
literally cannot imagine a better gig for you.
Yeah.
At this stage of your life, I cannot imagine a better gig. Knowing your heart and how you operate, this is perfect. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. Thanks. I like it. It's a good job. And so I do a standard travel safety brief where I teach people how to be safe, how to travel safely. Mm-hmm. The second half of what I offer is when they're traveling, we'll use Rome. I'm just using this right now. If you're traveling to Rome, I find out where you're staying and I build you a package similar to what I would have provided in the military, where I find the police station and the hospitals and where the embassy is and in relation to where you're staying, because you need to know where those things are. You may never have to use them, and I hope you never will. Most likely you'll never will. Yeah. But wouldn't that be nice to know as a parent? If your child is traveling overseas and they have their backpack stolen, that they know where they are and they can make their way to a police station.
I don't have kids, but I was a youth pastor for a long time and I get to be the cool uncle in my family. And then, you know, Tuesday night, we have a couple older teenagers that are hanging out doing the adult class. Because they kind of have outgrown the kids class, but they're still kids, you know, and they don't train with the adults. They come as a pair and then they train together in their own section of the mat. And then I go over, and like a couple weeks ago, they were like, yeah, we're walking home tonight. And I was like, not happening.
Yeah.
Too dark. Yeah. It's too cold. I know your dad. Get him down here. If I were all that to say that if I had kids, I think I would be obnoxiously overprotected and I wouldn't literally let my kids go to the next town without having them knowing what to do, let alone flying to the other side of the earth. And, you know, living in like fantasy land. Like, no, everything is going to be great. What?
Yeah. I would never in a million years discourage anyone from traveling, because I will submit to you, and I can say this, my personal opinion, I think traveling and getting world experience is on par, if not better, than getting a college education.
Especially in this day and age, you can learn whatever, unless you're going to be a surgeon or a lawyer or something.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it gives you a worldview. You get to learn other cultures. You understand other human beings better. It makes you more empathetic, right? All the things that make up a good human. So you should travel. And I don't want to ever say to someone, don't travel.
Yeah.
But when you look at, if you pull up the news right now, if you pull up online and type in a story, you know, someone hurt overseas or something bad happening overseas, not every time, but like a lot of things in life, if you look at it and Monday morning quarterback it, you probably can look and see there's a ton of stuff that happened to that individual on that day that had they chose differently and had they planned ahead, probably wouldn't have happened to them.
Yep.
Now there's things that you can't avoid, right? Like if you're standing there in Iceland and a volcano blows and wipes out an entire village, that was your day.
Can't do anything about the volcano.
You can do about it. But what you can do is, you know, like, and I always use this, this is like the worst case scenario, but I remember a couple of years ago, there were these two girls, young 19, 20 year old girls from a Scandinavian country. They traveled to Morocco on their own and went backpacking in the mountains. And they were killed by Al-Qaeda, right? That's not a good idea, right?
Yeah. Or
we've heard stories about, you know, college age kids backpacking on the Iran-Iraq border.
Don't do that.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Go someplace else. Go to Cancun.
Right? Right? We'll use Mexico, too. Mexico is a dynamic up and down. Some places are safe. Some places aren't. Right? Would you go to Juarez? Not a good idea. I wouldn't go to Juarez myself. I wouldn't go to
Mexico. I was going to say, I'm not going to Juarez.
If I wouldn't go to Juarez with a platoon of Green Berets. Right? It's dangerous there.
Right.
So my point, and those are gross exaggerations. Your average college kid isn't going to do any of that stuff. But, you know, things like staying out of certain neighborhoods, being aware that certain crime takes place. Some cities are known for a type of crime versus other cities, right?
Mm. Back to jujitsu. And for anybody listening that has kids that travel or are traveling, I will put all of Kurt's contact information in the show notes so that you can check out comehomesafe.com. And you may or may not want to answer this question, seeing as though we trained together. But what position all these years? You've trained for about 9 years, is that right?
Yeah, I'm in my ninth year, yeah.
Okay, so you're in your ninth year of jiu-jitsu, which whenever I hear like you or Jeff or a bunch of our other guys, I sometimes leave class and I'm just like so frustrated. And it's like, okay, Kurt has been training almost twice as long as I have. Like I'm coming up on my fifth year. You're in your ninth year, you know? So, but all these years into it, what's the position that you still dread? What do you hate being in? Maybe let's say Liam catches you in this position or somebody who's tougher for you than I am.
No, I can tell you right now, the biggest one right now is being mounted.
Right? Really?
Yeah. And mounted by specific people, mounted by Matt Ulrich.
I was going to say it.
Right?
Yeah, it's awful.
I'll say it all day. He's very, very good. Very strong there.
I know. Long legs.
Yeah. I'm a big guy. I'm older. I'm not as athletic. I'm not as in shape as I should be compared to some of these guys. So I find myself, I'm in a half guard or on my back a lot. You know, not all the time. Part of that is I enjoy being in that spot because I like being in bad positions. So I do try, and especially early on in jiu-jitsu, my jiu-jitsu journey, I was just so So horrible. I spent so much time on my back, and that's why Liam really had me working underhooks for, you know, there was like 6 months I wasn't allowed to do anything but an underhook. And then wrestle up onto my knees, you know, and then on top. If you're a big guy, you're a big, strong guy, being on top is almost cheating, I think, in a lot of
ways. I agree. Right?
It's, if you want to just stay on top and get on top, that's great. But when you outweigh the person by 100 pounds, and especially if you got a little more skill, being on top is not even, I don't want to say challenging, but it's almost cheating in a way, right?
Yeah.
You're so big.
I agree.
You're a human being, right? So if you know you're okay there, why don't you play on your side or your back, right?
Right.
And then I'll use Matt again as an example. When he first started, he would leave these gaps. I could see daylight underneath his butt.
There's no gaps anymore.
Yeah. Now there's no gaps. And if he sweeps me, which he does all the time, and he ends up on top of me, which he does all the time.
Yep.
Especially with a guy with a bad shoulder, I get crushed every single time. Mm. So I just said it to him this morning. People that don't train jiu-jitsu would hear that and they'd be like, that sounds horrible. Why would you ever do that? And I'm like, well, because I'm going to drill this. I'm going to work this one spot until I'm awesome at it. And now I beat that, right? So again, I'm not getting comfortable. I'm growing. I'm getting better. But you have to put your ego aside and say, hey, man, staying on top is easy for me.
Yeah,
that's something that's not easy for me. And that's how many times am I tapping up with you and I'm already lying on my back? Because,
well, you let me, I mean, you often, typically the way I feel like our roles go lately is we roll and like, we do our thing where you prove to me that you know jiu-jitsu. And then when there's like 2 minutes left on, you like, will have me put you in a bad position. Which is, yeah. I enjoy it.
You all good. I'm glad. Cause I think anybody, if you're coming into jiu-jitsu, your only goal is to dominate and beat people up.
It's awful.
You're there for the wrong reasons.
Right? I completely agree.
If you're there to make yourself a better human on so many different levels.
Yeah. Right?
Some of which we talked about, some of which we haven't, you're in the right spot. And I think you have to constantly say, what am I not good at? Where do I end up a lot, and where does it suck, right, for me?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, and work those. I mean,
I'm working this half guard bottom game right now, and I'm getting my ass handed to me, but I'm getting a little further every time. I'm getting a little further every time.
Yeah. Now, think about that. Think about if you're big, you're strong, you feel confident on top, and then you end up in like a half guard.
Yeah.
You're really good at it. It's no factor, right? You're like, well, that's cool. And now... And, you know, and then before you know it, you're able to go from a bad spot to a good spot.
A better spot, yeah. I got to this point in the conversation with Liam where without getting too soft here, you for me are somebody that I have really looked up to as a training partner and somebody who, when we talk about like the family of jiu-jitsu, your demeanor, your kindness, your time, your attention, your generosity on and off the mat, I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful that you are someone that I get to train with.
Oh, thanks, man. I really enjoy all you guys, and it's been such a, It does put a smile on my face, right? It's got
it does. At inconvenient times.
Well, yeah. And jiu-jitsu's got me through a lot of tough times. And I know I'm not the only one that says this. This is almost cliche at this point.
Yeah.
You know, that it's like life and it gets you through this and gets you through that. But it's true, it does.
Yep.
And you know, I love the community aspect of jiu-jitsu.
Our academy is incredible, isn't it?
Right. I think if anyone's training and they are not happy where they're training, you have freedom of choice, go leave. They're guaranteed you the next place you're going to go is better than where you were.
Except if you're at First Colony, because I don't think it gets a lot better than our place.
Well, everyone's great and they are a family. And the culture is that it's not about beating Jim Trick today. It's about myself better.
Right.
If that results in a sub, That's great.
If that results in you beating Jim Trick, which it did this morning, and it probably will tomorrow morning, then you know.
Right. But I think it's awesome. And I think it's a great the one thing I was telling someone the other day, and I know the whole point of your business and your podcast is to educate and attract certainly newer jiu-jitsu members, right? Or newer jiu-jitsu practitioners, right?
Yep.
And I think that's great. And I think that people should come in, people should be welcomed with open arms.
Yeah.
Warm and friendly.
Yes. So that's my job at First Colony. That guy.
Well, and I love it because there should be no hazing or anything like that. Jiu-jitsu is tough enough as it is, right?
It's tough enough.
And what do they say? You know, I don't want to misquote anyone famous, but I remember hearing that, like, if 100 people show up to jiu-jitsu, it was like one will make their black belt or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Something really wild. So it's already self-selecting anyways, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of those 99 are going to leave for a variety of reasons, right?
That's true.
They should never leave because somebody wasn't warm or smiling.
There was some kind of, like, you know, hazing kind of stuff.
No, I don't think so. I think it's jiu-jitsu is like, if you're going to stick around, and that's one of the many things I like about jiu-jitsu. If you're going to stick around and you're going to get your black belt,
right,
it shows that you can fight through a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and there is some ball busting, but you know, it should be.
Yeah. But you can fight through life, right?
Yes, positively. Yeah.
You can fight through injury, illness. You can fight through a divorce. You can fight through, like, hey, man, my job sucks right now and I'm only able to get in twice a week.
Yep.
That may be the case for the next 6 months or a year.
Yep.
But
you're not stopping.
And then maybe, stopping. You know, because I can tell you when I first started, I was working midnights. I would shift within at 7. This class started at 7. I can't tell you how many times Liam was like, hey, be there, you know, show up when you can. I'm there at 7:20. I've been up all night. I'm tired. I'm like, I gotta get a roll in. I gotta train at least for an hour, you know? It's a grind. And it just shows, like, it shows how uncomfortable do you want to make yourself and how much better do you want to make yourself as a human being?
That's the question. Thank you for doing my white belt, Kurt Veed. This has been so fun.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay, so that was my conversation with my dear friend and training partner, Kurt Veed. And listen, here's the thing. He's a brown belt in jiu-jitsu. He is a battle-tested warrior on a lot of different fronts. And he's formidable, and he's big and strong and skilled. So here's the thing. You wouldn't want to be... Certainly, you wouldn't want to be on his bad side, or you wouldn't want to be in a position where he has to deal with you. But he doesn't walk through life like a hardo. He's fun and friendly and warm and kind and open, and he will... he'll not only help you with your jiu-jitsu, but he'll talk to you about life and he'll look you in the eye and he'll say, yeah, no, sometimes things are really hard. Sometimes things are really tough. And he'll, like, put an arm around you and be a friend. And he is a good man. And if you are a dude listening to this and you live your life demanding that people respect you and walking around like with a chip on your shoulder and making your insecurity known to the world, Kurt is the opposite of that. And so he's somebody that I've trained with for the last 5 years. I look up to him. It was an honor for me to get to have him on the show and to share him with all of you. I will put the link in the show note to his thing. If you have kids that are traveling overseas, he really is doing a great service for people. I hope you'll head over to mywhitebelt.com to sign up for My White Belt Wednesday. It's our newsletter. I hope that you'll pick up a t-shirt to show your support for My White Belt. I hope that you will go and like and subscribe and do all of those things that I ask you to do. Write a review on Apple and Spotify. Give us 5 stars. And of course, until next week, I'm Jim Trick. This is My White Belt. Train hard and train smart.